Okay, well, while the last people are coming in, I'll do the introductions. Welcome to this lunchtime debate, East Asia, the new global hotspot. My name is Rob Lyons. I'm the associate editor of the online magazine Spiked, and in a change to the published programme, as they say on the television, I'll be chairing this debate. If you want your to tweet your views, I believe the hashtag is hashtag Battle of Ideas. Gideon Rachman in the FT earlier this year said, the flickering black and white films of men going over the top in the First World War seem impossibly distant, yet the idea that the great powers of today could ever stumble into war as they did in 1914 is far too complacent. The rising tensions between China, Japan and the US have echoes of the terrible conflict that broke out almost a century ago. Rachman's not alone in that view. In June, a former Assistant US Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, Kirk Campbell, wrote again in the FT that there is a feel of 1914 in the air. And two Australian academics writing in February also drew parallels with 1914, noting in the early years of the 20th century, most pundits considered a major war between the great powers a remote possibility. The most obvious focus of these concerns are the tensions over the ownership of the Senkaku Islands, currently controlled by Japan but claimed by both China and Taiwan. However, there are also a number of other potential flashpoints in East Asia, not the least being whatever happens about North Korea and the latest developments there. Then add into the mix the US government's so-called pivot to Asia in the last couple of years, which may be seen to heighten tensions with China, and you can see why commentators might express concern about the situation. But is it all overblown? Do these various countries involved have too much to lose to get involved in a military conflict? And I'm very glad we have an expert panel here to discuss that very issue. I'll introduce them in the order they speak. So on my far right is Ben Chu. He's been economics editor of The Independent since 2011, having previously been chief leader writer and deputy comment editor at the newspaper. He's the author of a brand spanking new book. I think it's officially out this week, is that right?
Last week.
Here it is, Chinese Whispers, Why Everything You've Heard About China Is Wrong, which is an excellent primer on the state of China today and its relationship with the outside world. Well worth your $13.99 and it's available at the bookstall, so please do pick up a copy. To my immediate right is Professor Steve Tsang. He's Director of the China Policy Institute and Professor of Contemporary Chinese Studies at the School of Contemporary Chinese Studies at the University of Nottingham. He previously ran the Asia Studies Centre at St Anthony's College, Oxford, and he's the author or co-author of 16 books, which I think makes him officially prolific. Steve also coined the term consultative Leninism to describe the nature of politics in China. And on my left is James Woodhausen. He's Professor of Forecasting and Innovation at De Montfort University in Leicester. He's the co-author, among other things, of Energize, A Future for Energy Innovation. He regularly lectures on forecasting to Indian and Chinese audiences and has consulted for Mitsubishi and Yokogawa on forecasting matters. He's also written quite widely on India, China and Japan, including currently for China Outlook, which is a subscription website. So our speakers are going to talk for 5 to 7 minutes each to outline their views, and then I'll bring you in for your questions and contributions as well. So without any further ado, Ben.
Good afternoon. I'm going to start by reading you the titles of a number of books that have been written about China in the West over the past decade or so. The Coming Conflict with China, Hegemon, China's Plan to Dominate Asia and the World, The China Threat, Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States, Red Dragon Rising, Communist China's Military Threat to America, Beware the Dragon, China, 1,000 years of bloodshed. Are you feeling scared yet? And this very dark vision is supported by a number of academic voices. Robert Kagan, the political scientist, describes China as having what he calls a 19th century soul. It's a country filled with nationalist pride, ambitions and resentments, consumed with questions of territorial sovereignty. Niall Ferguson, the Harvard historian, draws a very dark analogy with Germany. Rapid growth, internal instability, youthful nationalism. I, for one, am reminded of the way that Germany made its bid for world power 100 years ago, a bid that led ultimately to the First World War. And you can, if you look at China today, you can find evidence to support this view. In 1996, a group of academics wrote a very influential book called China Can Say No, in which they urged the authorities in Beijing to be more assertive on the global stage. They followed that up in 2009 with a collection of essays called Unhappy China, and one of the things they demanded was that China should stop self-debasing and recognise the fact that it now has power to lead the world. And in a very stark message to the US, they said, you can start a war if you have the guts, otherwise shut up. But what about ordinary Chinese people? Do they share these views? Well, you can find evidence that they do. If you look at 1999, when NATO accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in the Kosovan War, killing three Chinese journalists, there was mass protests outside the U.S. embassy in Beijing. In the city of Chengdu, protesters tried to burn down the American embassy. Many foreign visitors in China at the time reported being flabbergasted by the strength of feeling that this had provoked. Last year, when the diplomatic spat between China and Japan over the Diaoyu's islands, the Senkaku Islands, was overflowing, there were protests in 85 Chinese cities. Japanese targets were attacked indiscriminately, restaurants, businesses. One man, a Chinese man, was put in a coma when he was attacked by the mob. And what was his crime? Driving a Japanese manufactured car. But what I want to argue today is that this is a caricature, and a misleading caricature of where China is. For a start, let's think about the Chinese people. This is what one netizen, an online commentator, said about those riots, those anti-Japanese riots last year. He said, "Foreign reporters, when you cover anti-Japanese protests, can you please give up the use of terms that may hurt innocent people, like residents of Beijing, citizens of Shanghai? Can you be more direct and more accurate? Use terms like hundreds of suspicious people in Beijing, a great batch of dumbasses in Shanghai, a bunch of nutcases in Shenzhen." And I think he had a point. We had riots in this city of London in 2011, and if a Chinese journalist had come over and said that the entire population of London is up in arms, looting and pillaging shops, we would be scandalised by that. It's a completely inaccurate characterisation. And I think We make the same mistake when we assume that all Chinese are aggressive militarist nationalists just waiting to go on the rampage. But there's another point that I want to make, and that's that's often overlooked, I think. It's the link between Chinese nationalism and Chinese political reform, Chinese democracy movement. This has been there from the very earliest days, from Sun Yat-sen, whose Free Principles of the People in the early 20th century. They were people's livelihood, people's nationalism, but the third one was people's democracy. It was there in the 1919 May the 4th movement. This was an anti-imperialist movement when Chinese territories were transferred from Germany to Japan. This was a nationalist movement, huge protest, but it was also a movement for political reform. And this, what I call an umbilical link between Chinese nationalism and Chinese democracy, still exists today. It wasn't much covered, but in last year, in the anti-Japanese riots, there was a banner in the city of Guangzhou, which people had made, and it said, "Turn fury into power. Desire political reform." In 2008, when the Sichuan earthquake occurred, a number of schools collapsed, and it was believed that corrupt local officials and corrupt construction companies had built these buildings with substandard cement. One nationalist blogger put his feelings like this: "Patriotism is about constructing fewer extravagant offices for the bureaucrats and building more structures for farmers. Patriotism is about drinking less baijiu, using public money. Patriotism is about allowing people more freedom in our country and letting our children study in the city where they wish to study. Patriotism is about dignity for the Chinese people." Now, am I arguing that Chinese nationalism is a wholly benign force? Of course not. There are extremists in China, as there are in every country. But the point I would like you to come away with is that Chinese nationalism is not simply a tool in the hands of the Beijing government, in the Communist Party. It is a potential existential threat as well to the Chinese Communist Party. And this caricature of Chinese as mindlessly aggressive is extremely damaging. There is a progressive dimension to Chinese nationalism. It's always been there, and it is still there. So let's leave you the thought that next time you hear the words Chinese nationalism, let's hope that two other words pop into your head as well, Chinese democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ben. Steve.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. I would like to address, first of all, the title of this panel, which is on East Asia, the new global hotspot. And I would suggest to you that it is not the new global hotspot, at least not yet, but potentially it is. And that is something that we have to bear in mind. And obviously, our discussions and for policymakers, the key is how to preempt that, to make sure that East Asia does not become the new global hotspot. I'll say a few words about the North Korean situation, and then I'll focus on China, which is really my main focus. In terms of the North Korean situation, it is something that we get very worried about, because we're talking about a new de facto nuclear weaponed state, where its young leader has been pretty reckless and been provoking quite a lot of incidents in the region in the last couple of years. What I'll put it to you is that, yes, he is reckless, but his provocations were all very carefully calculated. And because they were so very carefully calculated, that the chance of them simply completely getting out of hand is not as high as it might appear from reading the news. The Chinese are supporting the North Korean regime, and often you hear in the media about all kinds of so-called Chinese national interest calculations, like the if North Korea should collapse, what the danger of North Korean refugees flooding into China would be like. Those are minor considerations. The real fundamental reason why the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party will support North Korea is for the very simple reason that the North Korean party is one of the very few, less than a handful, of remaining communist state parties in the world. And the Chinese Communist Party sustains it. It cannot afford to let that party collapse, as then it will set an example for the sustainability of the Communist Party in China. And that is the only reason why it will support it. It is not supporting that reckless provocation otherwise. Going back to China, you may well have heard about the China dream that the new Chinese leader Xi Jinping has been talking about since he came to power a year ago. Now, sometimes there's some confusion as to what the China dream is. Let me explain that as far as the Communist Party is concerned, as far as Xi Jinping is concerned, there's no confusion. There's only one China dream. There are not multiple China dreams. And the only China dream is that of Xi Jinping's dream, not anybody else's. Other Chinese, you can dream as much as you like. They don't matter very much in this particular equation. And in that China dream, it is a dream of a rich country and a powerful military. And that is what it is all about. And it's very much tied in to what the Communist Party's narrative of the century of humiliation, which essentially was the 100 years between the First Anglo-Chinese War of 1839 to the end of the Second World War, or rather from the Communist Party's perspective, until 1949, when the Communist Party came to power in China. Then it was supposed to have been ended. But they're still talking about it in terms of the century of humiliation. The fact that China lost a pre-modern superpower for nearly 2,000 years and dominated that part of the world for much of that 2,000 years. And for 100 years, it was not dominating, but was being dominated. Was not a big issue that they recognize. So this is a very, very important element in terms of what it is all about. It is about reasserting China's rightful place in the world. And that is a very important thing in terms of what they are trying to do. I mean, it's not a very clear idea in terms of what is China's rightful place it is in the world. And we can discuss what that would be. But where I think it really does get worrying is that this is also about a particular brand of nationalism. And here I would disagree quite a bit with what Ben has talked about, Chinese nationalism. The nationalism that the Communist Party promotes mostly since the 1980s, when communism had collapsed as a state ideology in China, and that modified Leninist system, I call it the consultative Leninist political system, still requires an ideology to provide that cohesion for the Leninist states to work. That's when they introduced this particular brand of nationalism. What it amounts to is basically my party, right or wrong, but it's being dressed up as my country, right or wrong. Let's not forget, in the political system that exists in China, the Communist Party owns China. It's not the other way around. The Communist Party is not the governing party in China. It's not the ruling party of China. The Communist Party owns China. The People's Liberation Army is not China's National Defense Forces. It is the military forces of the Communist Party. Now, if we can see that, and we also then have to see that in that particular brand of nationalism that the Chinese Communist Party advocates, Japan occupies a particularly important place. Almost all Chinese kids will have been brought up with the understanding and memory, and they actually emphasize the word memory, of Japanese atrocities from the Second War and just before the Second World War. And therefore, there's this almost pathological hatred of the Japanese. So when we are dealing with issues like the Sengoku Island or Diaoyu Island disputes, it is very, very dangerous. We also need to bear in mind that the real risk of China getting into a problem with its neighbors and with the United States behind those neighbors is a matter of miscalculation, not a matter of policy. China does not have a policy of going to pick a war with Japan or with the United States or its neighbors. But miscalculations can happen. To bring it back to the First World War or pre-First World War analogy of the trickiness, in the First World War, one of the problems of the situation being very difficult to control was the need for mobilization, the joke about the rigidity of the German train timetable, that they had to decide whether they're going to mobilize. If they mobilize, they have to put the troops on the train, otherwise they couldn't do it. In the case of China, it's the rigidity of that nationalism. The point that Ben raises about that nationalism is a two-edged sword. The party itself, having promoted nationalism, is also being driven and conditioned and constrained by nationalism. Imagine any Chinese leader being able to say in a maritime territorial dispute with Japan that it is going to back down. What pressure there will be behind that leader to deal with it. And of course, from China's perspective, in all its territorial disputes with its neighbors, whether it's East China Sea, South China Sea, Taiwan, Tibet, all behind them is one other country called the United States. There, you've got a problem there. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thanks very much. James.
Well, for the cosmopolitans among you, you might be interested to know that British Airways opened a weekly flight to Chengdu, China's fourth largest city, just last month. And for the rail fans here, you might be interested to know that Chengdu has opened a new rail line to Poland. The deliveries are 12 days, but that's probably quicker than you can do by tanker or by the usual methods, bar air freight. So I think the first thing to say is that is East Asia the hotspot? Not necessarily, but wellsprings of heat can certainly come from East Asia. In the week that George Osborne has declared that the renminbi will chiefly be traded outside China in London, I think we can see that even in Europe, the tensions that happen in East Asia will have their effect. And we can also trace it in China's being granted by Osborne just this week 100% ownership of British nuclear power plants, should it want it. So there may not be a blow up in East Asia, but I think as a place in the world, it's more significant, has more to offer than the Middle East, which is currently seen as the main wellspring of world conflict. And I think, you know, when we're thinking about North Korea and the Republic of Korea, when we look at that situation, it's unstable, it's unresolved, it's nuclearized, and in many ways it speaks volumes about all of those characteristics of post-war and indeed the whole of the 20th century Asian growth. Asian growth has always been impetuous but unresolved and unstable, and just this first 6 months, Japan has grown by an astonishing 4%. Which makes our 1% recovery in Britain look pretty useless. Having said that the region is special in this regard and the tensions are fierce, we also have to remember, as Steve has reminded us, that it's never simply an intra-regional conflict that's going down, most obviously between Japan and China. Even the American handover of the Senkaku Islands to Japan in 1972 has led to a very bitter and fierce legacy. And the same is true, in fact, of Okinawa, handed back to the Japanese in 1972. The Chinese now have some designs on that, or not the Chinese, I should say, taking Ben's point, but figures in the Chinese administration. And not only Senkaku and Okinawa, but also Taiwan, all derived from the Cold War rule that America had. And America remains a very important power in the whole area, adding to the tensions. So I hope that's a proper characterization of the area as a hotspot. Second question, does China feel threatened? In the blurb for this session, the point is made that China feels threatened by the encirclement of Japan and America and other powers. I'm not certain that it really feels threatened. I think in his 2009 paper about the the consultative Leninism, a delightful term from Steve there. Having been a Leninist for most of my life, I'm not sure I recognize the Chinese Communist Party as Leninist, but I like the kind of contradiction there between consultation and Leninism. If you look at what Steve said in that paper, I think China does feel that it is more confident after that century of humiliation. It won't be pushed around anymore. It makes the point that it's different, and China doesn't have to be bound by Western standards of democracy. And it also makes a point, according to Steve, that the West is uncomfortable with China's rise. So does China feel threatened by the Japanese Navy or even by the American pivot? Not especially, I don't believe. America far outweighs China in defense forces and all of these things. But in cybersecurity, probably China is ahead of Japan. And in drones, it's an even contest over the Senkaku. So I don't know that it feels threatened. I think what it will do is stand up for itself, particularly in this tense region where you've got a delightful acronym soup. I hope Steve and Ben can help me out here. There's the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit that old Obama missed just a week or two back. The East Asia Summit, he missed that as well. Clearly, the Asian pivot of the Obama administration looks like a pirouette and then falling backwards to many people in the area. Then there's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. There's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, led by the Chinese. And then there's America's answer to it, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So you've got all of these different kind of trading and security arrangements in East Asia, and China feels not especially aggressive in all of that, doesn't want a war. I think Steve is right about that. But that certainly just the confusion of all the acronyms and the different alliances does speak to great instability there. And now, having said that, I don't think there are any parallels with the First World War. I think poor old Gideon Rachman and Philip Stevens on the Financial Times need to know more about the First World War before they start comparing the situation today with that. The whole geography is very different, the history is different, the national are very different, and there isn't really the kind of dreadnought war that we, dreadnought arms race and build up that we saw before the First World War. Now, just to conclude, I think the key question for this debate, in many ways, has been touched on by the previous speakers, which is what kind of nationalism are we dealing with in Japan? It's a very interesting thing given how many outbursts they've made in the recent few months saying that the loss of democracy under the Third Reich wasn't too much of a problem, and a few other things, but also, very importantly, Chinese nationalism. Now, here I've got to differ in the traditional battle of ideas style with both the other speakers. I don't think there's something very progressive, Sun Yat-sen, liberal, capitalistic, democratic about Chinese nationalism. I don't agree with Steve on that. I do believe that not all Chinese are xenophobic and all of these things, but I don't agree that the nationalism that he talked about has a progressive side to it. On the other hand, when Steve says that, you know, my party right or wrong, I think he's right about that. The Chinese Communist Party has tried to rally people to its cause by cultivating nationalism. But I think what we might profitably debate is what are the limits to nationalism in China. Steve has made the point in his paper that too much nationalism would tie the hands of China in any dispute with America. It would be unable to back down in the way that you say. Ben, I think, rightly makes the point that too much nationalism would impede the Chinese economy and not keep it open to foreign direct investment. And the exodus of Japan from China in that regard has been quite important in the last few years. And then finally, I think we can't say that the nationalism of Ben invokes is a existential potential threat to the Chinese regime. I think they do feel nervous about too much nationalism. It's quite interesting, if you just read the new issue of Global Times, they're saying that before we rush to condemn Japan, that's the most nationalistic foreign policy organ in China, before we rush to condemn Japan, we've got to, you know, take a deep breath and not be too excited by these Japanese nationalists. So I do think that there is a problem there with Chinese nationalism. But it's not as lovely as Ben makes it out to be, nor quite as dangerous for the regime, perhaps, as Steve makes it out to be.
Okay, thank you, James. Okay, I was going to go straight out to the audience, but there was a bit of fighting talk there from James. So I'd like to give Ben and Steve maybe a minute each just to kind of come back on some of those points. Ben?
Yes. I think what I argued was not that Chinese nationalism is a wholly benign force in a Panglossian sense. What I would say, the point I was making, is that it has a progressive dimension to it. And it is, as Steve rightly characterised it, a potential double-edged sword for the regime. It isn't a tool in their hands. It isn't something that they can wield to exert influence on their neighbours. It's potentially destabilising for the regime. So I think the brand of nationalism, Steve is absolutely right, that is promoted by the Communist Party in schools and the popular discourse is deeply corrosive and quite dangerous as well. But that we mustn't overlook the complexity of the phenomenon of Chinese nationalism. We mustn't overlook its progressive democratic roots. This is part of the reality of modern China that modern Chinese people feel. And simply characterising it and presenting it in a similar light to the pre-war, pre-First World War German nationalism is a misreading of history.
OK, thanks, Steve.
Very quickly, 2 points. One is that Chinese nationalism and its progressive origins. I think the point about Sun Yat-sen is quite right. The three people's principles include both nationalism and democracy. What we have to bear in mind is that the Chinese Communist Party is not going to deliver democracy. The Chinese Communist Party is not non-democratic. It is anti-democratic. And we have to understand and accept that. And therefore, all that liberal tradition from three generations back really doesn't actually remain real in the current regime any longer. The corrosiveness of nationalism, I think, is very, very important. The Chinese complain about 0.02% of Japanese school textbooks being inaccurate and untruthful about the Second World War. In terms of Chinese school textbooks on the Second World War, it is 100% dishonest, untruthful, and wrong. 100%, not 99.9%, 100%. You simply cannot publish anything in China that does, in history textbooks that does not toe the party line. And then you have a problem in terms of getting the whole generation of people having a very different relationship with historical facts and with truth and with analysing the reality. The Chinese government time and again say the Japanese have not apologized enough for the war. Historical records will show that senior Japanese politicians time and again in the 1960s went to China, apologized to Chairman Mao for the atrocities in the war. And Chairman Mao time and again reassured them, said, there's nothing for you guys to apologize for. Had you not invaded China, the Communist Party would not have been in power. You have done China a great favor. No Chinese know that.
Okay, thanks. Right, now, I feel like I'm being interrogated by these lights, so please wave if you want to ask a question or make a contribution. Right, so let's start right up the top right, please.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. You've talked about nationalism within China, but is there potential instability such that regionalism could start actually changing the picture completely, and also different ethnic groups finding their identities? So do you think China will remain a very stable bloc, as it were, to exert its power as the sum of its population?
Any other questions? Yes, in the middle here, there's a gentleman in a dark top and then a gentleman in a grey top below him, so we can get the microphone along.
I was just interested in the demographic debate in terms of, you know, China is becoming a more male-dominated society. Will those angry young men have to be focused on an outside target in order to stop them from acting upon an inside target?
Okay, and then if you just pass it two rows in front of you. Great, thanks.
Thanks. This sounds like a kind of a lethal cocktail, maybe with correlates likewise to the
antecedent events to the Second World War, this idea that a country that had a right to primacy had been robbed of it for a period of time, and then this kind of national myth that we did no wrong, they did no right. In some sense, the lack of admission on both sides, it seems that there is a Chinese lack to admit that there's two sides to the story, but also there's a similar Japanese nationalism on the other side. So that seems like a lethal cocktail, and it seems that, you know, looking at pre-Second World War Germany, that doesn't play out well. But my question is, since the two countries now trade so much, that's very different to Europe at the time of either of these wars, with the globalism and innate dependence on each other, isn't that a mitigating force to some extent? And I'd like to just understand to what degree you think that might.
Okay, so there's a gentleman with a grey top, three or four rows back, so if you could just keep going up, that's great.
Does the economic growth in China, insofar as there's some people doing very, very nicely out of it, and some people being left behind, does this disparity of wealth that's resulting from this produce a potential for a catastrophic collapse of the state in China?
Okay, and if there's a gentleman down here on the left-hand side, so just right over here, keep waving. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wonder if it might help the discussion about nationalism if the panel could say a bit more about the content of that nationalism as to how that is expressed in China. I do have a question, which is, you know, I'm very interested in the amount of Chinese investment abroad, and obviously, I'd like to be able to map it as far as possible. But obviously, China is investing and becoming a significant player in a lot of different countries in all parts of the world, as far as I can tell. But I just wonder, in terms of selling that and how that discussion plays out in China and its relationship to these other parts of the world, is there a moral dimension to that beyond this is business, or is that as far as it goes? It's just making money, building China up. So how is it selling that sort of project to its people, and how does it see itself, its role in the world?
Okay, I'll bring the panel in just now. Don't feel you have to answer every single one of those questions. We'll be here all day. So just pick on the ones that you think you really have something to say. I might take you in reverse order. So, James.
Well, I think what you're hinting at the last point is that China is weak on soft power. And Ben is quite right to say that about China in his book, Soft Power, Diplomatic Power. I think when China announces Mars Base One, we'll see that Chinese soft power, in terms of legitimating the regime internationally and providing a kind of outbound focus for Chinese culture, for Chinese nationalism, beyond the Senkaku, so to speak, then that could well happen. Now, we've got the old canard that the exchange of foreign direct investment between Japan and China will necessarily militate against a war. A war is not going to happen anytime soon, but we know this is one lesson from the First World War, that in fact there was a great interpenetration of British and German capital before the First World War, arguably more extensive, given that Japan won't let Chinese investment into Japan. It's more extensive in the pre-First World War case, and it didn't prevent them from going to war. I think the interesting point has been made about the expansion of foreign direct investment outbound from China. And it's here that, again, despite having a more expensive hardback copy of your book, Ben, than Rob could invest in, I'm bound to differ in the spirit of Battle of Ideas. Because in your book, Ben, you quote an OECD forecast, and I think this is quite interesting, actually. 2011, if you'll follow the stats, and I'll shut up in a sec, US 28% of world output, China 17%, EU 17%. 2030, according to OECD forecasts, and we can't take them too seriously, but US still at China at 28, US down at, to 18, and little old EU down to 9. And you say in your book, Ben, you know, it could be the biggest economy, China, but it won't outweigh the rest of the world. Well, I understand that, but if you're at 28% and America down to 18 and EU down to 9, then for you to say, as you do on page 207, the world, it could be the world's biggest economy, but with only limited influence beyond its borders. I put it to you that given the latest McKinsey report, Q3, on outbound FDI from China, it's moved from $1 billion in the year 2000 to $100 billion in 2011. And indeed, in many ways, as I'm sure you'd agree, it's only just beginning. So what I'm trying to say is, if it's 28% of the world economy in 2030, it might not be a hegemon. I appreciate the need for nuance, but it's pretty powerful stuff if America's reduced to 18%. Secondly, its global influence will make sure that even if the hotspot isn't in East Asia, hotspots can derive from that part of the world, given wherever Chinese foreign direct investment is. So I do think we have to grasp that it is very much an international player. It cannot be divorced from the rest of the world economy any more than America can pull out of Asia. It just can't be done. You're talking a lot of integration and therefore more tension.
Okay. Can I just defend myself here? This is Ben's personal copy of it. Being a 21st century kid, mine's on Kindle. Okay, thank you. Steve.
Well, thank you. I will perhaps focus on the questions about the sustainability issues, both in terms of the inequality and the ethnic issues. To do that, let me sort of echo what James said at the end in terms of those forecasting. A lot of these kind of forecastings are based on a kind of linear projection, and there are always problems with the linear projections. And in this case, inevitably, the projections have to ignore the imponderables. And the imponderables comes up in the questions that you are asking about what about the regional diversities and autonomies, and what about the ethnic groups, and can China actually hold itself up together as a coherent whole for the next 20, 30, 40 years? Now, that is a big question. If you look at places like Tibet or Xinjiang is where most of the Muslim Uyghur people live, you can see that Chinese rule in Tibet and in Xinjiang, the Chinese would absolutely be furious if that word's been used. It's basically old-fashioned imperialism or colonialism. And there are problems being developed over there. China does not at the moment face a problem with terrorism of an Islamic type, but that is being promoted by the Chinese oppression of the Muslim people in that part of the world. And so there is a big problem there. I'll come back to this. The second one is, of course, that huge disparity that exists in China. The Gini coefficient in China has, in the last few years, been banned. Previously, it was available data. Now it is classified state secret because it's got to a stage where national security is at stake. The state can't allow the information to be released. The real issue is stability. Up to this point, the Communist Party has been absolutely very capable in maintaining stability, order, by delivering rapid growth. That very rapid growth is going to slow down. When that slows down, things will get difficult between the rich and poor, between the different national ethnic groups and the dominant Han national group. If the Communist Party itself splits at the top and cannot simply do what it takes to suppress whatever challenges, uprisings should arise, then you've got a problem. You get into the 1989 spring situation when political paralysis caused a major upswell of popular movement in Beijing and in many other cities that at that time potentially could have caused the party to collapse. But the party used force to restore that effectively on that occasion. Can they do it again? We don't know. So that linear projection is a very questionable one, whether we will actually ever get to there.
Ben. Yes, I'd like to answer, well, to take the first question about is China a cohesive national bloc, and also link it to the other question that Steve answered about inequality and the threat that poses to the regime. And I think these are two really key points when one is considering the nature of contemporary Chinese nationalism. In my opening address, I was talking about popular conceptions of nationalism. Now I'm talking about the regime's conception. And the point to make is that I think those analogies about China being like Germany on the eve of the First World War, or even a 19th century colonial power, are very, very wrong, because those powers were, at those times were looking at external expansion. I think the dominant concern of the Communist Party in China today is internal cohesion. Of course, they're worried about incursions from Japan and the various border disputes, but they are not looking to project their power. They're not looking to invade vast other regions of the world in the same way that those previous powers were. They're concerned about, as Steve rightly said, the separatist movements in Tibet, in Xinjiang. They are concerned about creating enough jobs to keep the population happy, keeping enough jobs, keeping up enough economic growth to keep living standards rising. These are what I think the regime wakes up every day, the senior politicians in the regime think wake up every day and worry about. And if we conceptualize them, if we imagine them, like a sort of expansive power looking for Lebensraum, looking for colonies in Africa, that's a fundamental misreading in my view. We have to understand that their predominant concern, it seems to me, is with internal stability, with staying in power themselves.
Okay, thank you. So, any more comments? I was reminded when Ben was reading out that list of books at the start that the book flying off the airport shelves sort of 22 years ago was The Coming War with Japan. So the things can move on very, very quickly in geopolitics. Any more questions or responses? Yes, down here, please.
Hello. Mine is more of a comment rather than a question. I think that the whole key here should be not looking at China as a unitary country, but looking at it as more countries. After living in Shanghai for 1 year and a half, different provinces, different languages, different cultures, different. And I have to agree with Ben here that it seems to me that the government is increasingly starting to look at stability and trying to provide everything for the people. I don't know. This is what it seemed to me. I might be wrong because I was living, like, Shanghai is completely different than the rest of China. I have no idea what is happening, or I have a bit of an idea, but there might be people out there knowing much more than I do, so I'm not going to enter that. But I would ask, what do you think in terms of, like, unitary China? Like, can we talk about unitary China? Because I don't think we can. And this is a misconception that the Westerners have about China. And I admit I had it as well before going there.
Okay. Comments? Yes, down here at the front. Please wave your hand so I can sort of see you in advance. Thank you.
Hi. So just to turn the idea of sort of the business side on its head, there's a lot of international investment into China now. And in order to do that, you have to jump through so many hoops in order just to get your products into market or to manufacture there by forming joint partnerships with Chinese business. Now, are we being a little bit naive with this and sort of only serving to promote the views of the Communist Party and their ideals, and by jumping through their hoops and going after the quick buck instead of maybe developing more of a long-term plan for improvement.
Okay, keep waving. Yes, gentlemen.
Well, there hasn't really been, I haven't really heard much mentioned so far on like the current like resource problems which seem to be looming in the future, like for example the water shortages in the north, and I was wondering when, if ever, I mean, if the Chinese government actually has much of a hold on sorting out this problem, and when, if ever, it's going to explode into, you know, whether it could be the thing which kicks off this global hotspot that China could become.
Okay. Any other questions? There's another one down here. Yes, please.
Mine is coming back to the centre of the conversation today. Is it really a hotspot? And at the end of the brochure, where it says, is Asia the cockpit of tomorrow's major war? So what would it take to actually lit the flame and became hell in there?
Okay, that kind of brings us back to some of the miscalculation discussion earlier on as well. Right, one more point. In the middle there, lady with the glasses. And then I'll bring the panel back in.
It kind of relates to the point before. You say it's not a hotspot yet. Do you think it could become a superpower? And if so, would it be a unipolar or bipolar world?
Is it all about China? This discussion has turned into one of... So America's getting an easy ride here, I notice. And so I'll bring the panel back in again. So, Ben, if you're...
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. The last one, is it a bipolar world, a multipolar world? Is China going to be a superpower? I think some of these terms are a bit anachronistic, particularly the word superpower. We imagine, I suppose, the classic conception is America after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Was America a superpower? In many senses, I suppose you could argue that it was, but it couldn't shape the world in its own image. We tried that in Iraq, tried that in Afghanistan. It didn't work. There were real constraints on it. I think part of the problem when we think about China is we instantly look back to our own history. We think about the 19th century. We think of where European states and America behaved towards Africa, towards Asia. And we go into this kind of... We project onto China our own behaviour. We think China's going to behave in the same way that we did, if you like. And I think this is fundamentally wrong because the world is a fundamentally different place. Countries have nuclear weapons. You can't march into them willy-nilly. There is international law is a very fragile thing, but it is a constraint on what nations can do. So I think... Let's get away from this conception of China being a superpower, because it's not really that useful. It's a power, sure. It will have influence, to go back to the points James was making. No doubt. It will have economic influence, diplomatic influence. But it will not be ruling the world as a common presentation of it is.
Okay. Steve?
I'll focus on the question about resources and whether the party is providing mostly what people need and want in China. The party in the last 10, 20 years has been doing a very good job in terms of providing for things in China. I think most Chinese really have their living conditions hugely improved, and that would give rise to that particular perception. But a lot of that was being achieved by robbing the next generation. And that is the question that was being raised about the water shortage. North China is running out of underground water, not surface water, but underground water is being depleted. The scale of pollution in a huge tract of China are now so bad that it's going to take a very, very, very long time, an enormous, unbelievable amount of investments to clean that country up. Air in China, in most Chinese cities, are so unhealthy that you don't want to live there or you don't want to raise children there. And that will have to be paid for by somebody else. And the water shortage problem is being resolved. They have huge projects to deal with water shortage problem, one of which is to divert water from the Yangtze River in the middle of the country to the Yellow River in the north, and to also divert water from the Himalaya sources into the North China River system so that it will relieve the water shortage problems in North China. Now, you've got two problems. One is that we don't know how much water actually will be able to deliver there without having been lost in seepage, and therefore how much problem it will resolve in North China's water shortage. And it's enormously expensive. And secondly, the ecological consequences for the Yangtze River is not looked at carefully. And we are going to have a huge problem over there. And thirdly, a whole range of countries in southern China, southern Asia and Southeast Asia, where a lot of their main river systems also originate from the Tibetan Petroad, are going to be running short of water as a result. All this can happen because the particular political system has that capacity to deliver when it is united and can use that political capacity to do so. Is it a good thing? Well, it depends on what time frame you want to look at. It depends on the context you want to look at. Will that be a cause for a water war, as it were? I suspect probably not, because most of China's neighbours really are not in a capacity, in a league that could challenge China in that sense.
Okay, James.
I think resource shortages and resource wars are completely overestimated in the popular literature, and the chief culprit here is an East Coast Massachusetts professor called Michael Clare, K-L-A-R-E. If you look at the recent article I just did for China Outlook on shale gas, you'll find that whatever your feelings about shale gas and the enormous amount of water that it absorbs to make shale gas, China, which is best endowed with shale gas worldwide, more than even America, it has a need for 1 billion cubic meters of water to deal with its own shale gas if it managed to make 100 billion cubic meters of gas by 2020. It needs a billion cubic meters of water to do all of that. It's got 600 billion cubic meters of water right now, and the state wants to restrict consumption to 700 billion. So if China can properly absorb shale gas and do the water for that, then in potential at least, it can easily handle any resource problems that are thrown its way. Even though it, very importantly, like the rest of Asia, lacks fossil fuels locally, and that's one of the reasons it is in Africa. And here I think Ben is entirely right in his book. Commodity shortages rather than imperialism in Africa is what's motivating China there. Now, where Ben is also right, I think, is to say that to hint that the regime still has the capacity to, even though it's got plenty of water actually in China, still got the capacity to screw everything up. And Ben makes a point that the growth in the last 30 years, which Steve was just applauding, happens despite the Communist Party, not because of it. And I think you're entirely right about that. So the experience with the Three Gorges Dam and the kinds of pollution that Steve talks about are very much the responsibility of the Chinese Communist Party. I think we need to get it a bit in perspective. I think it's quoted in in Ben's book, in fact, that 8 to 13% of Chinese GDP is being eroded by pollution. That's an enormous figure. I mean, it's bad, but it can't be 13% of Chinese GDP, Ben. That's really too much. Now, just so finally, what would it take, which relates to this, is not going to be a resource war or a resource shortage that is going to overturn the Chinese Communist Party. Nor do I believe that it's going to be excessive nationalism, given that even Global Times, which is pretty nationalistic, is worried about being excessively nationalistic. I think where the potential existential threat that Steve talks about is not in excessive nationalism is in fact in the Chinese working class. And in this respect, Steve, your remarks about the Gini coefficient and inequality are very important. It's made the point is made in your book, Steve, that nearly every day there are mass outbreaks of strikes and, you know, people adopting French tactics. You know, in Britain we have the TUC. In France and China, they take a battering ram to the local police station. Not quite in China. They're not that French. But, you know, they are... They often blame the local government, not the central government in all of this. They, are, in fact, argue the central government should come down there and sort out some of these problems, you know. So... I think now, what would it take, just to conclude on that point, for a real Fissi-Paris dispute to break out? I think one thing we shouldn't forget is that, you know, the policy in relation to war is not just the clash of nation states, not where battle of ideas is coming from. It also involves clashes between different classes. So I wanted to ask Steve what he thought the significance of the Bo Xilai trial was, because I think internal dissent at the head of the Communist Party, such as you point out, Steve, was exhibited in the run-up to Tiananmen Square massacre, that, along with class struggle, is a big factor towards bringing about a war originating in that area. It's not just a state-to-state conflict. It's also the legitimacy of the Communist Party, the working-class struggles such as they exist, and the series of trials, in fact, since Bo Xilai, which I wondered if you could comment on, Steve. You're reading the runes more closely than me.
Right, before you do that, Steve, very final points. I'm going to let the speakers prepare their one-minute take-home message from this session. So we've got about literally 2 minutes for questions. Well, any final points? This gentleman again in the middle. You're all blown away by the internet.
There, I think there's some of them.
Yes. So one at the top as well, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Seems to be a tale of two Chinese Communist parties. One, the idea that command capitalism has allowed China's ascent, that in the face of American democratic and congressional atrophy and impasse, that the Chinese government has been able to be decisive, take on the major problems of the country, to control its currency values and so on, retain its foreign trade reserves, foreign investment, and so on. And then there's this other idea that actually all the success of China is despite the actions of the Communist Party. I'd be really interested to hear which of these stories you think is rings truest, has the most truth to it. Thank you.
Okay. We've got time for one more. That's that gentleman there.
Just to follow up what Ben said, you said that there is the Chinese government aren't really interested in colonialism in the old-fashioned sense. Isn't that just because they don't need to? Because there's so much overseas investment in countries around the world, but particularly in Africa, that they don't need to have an army there. They've already got the control of it through economic means. So that's the new colonialism.
Okay, that's all the questions. So I'm going to let the speakers sum up now. I'll leave Steve a little bit more time because James has thrown some questions at you. So, Steve, you'd like to kick off?
Yes, thank you. Bo Xilai case, I think Ben's subtitle for his book sums up it beautifully. Whatever the Chinese government tells you about the Bo Xilai case is wrong. It's something else. The Bo Xilai case is really about Bo Xilai as a rising Politburo member with his ambitions for a seat in the Politburo Standing Committee and pushing his particular political line that was not acceptable to the other leadership. And that is the reason why he was ousted. The murder of Mr. Haywood was just something that they used as an excuse with the defection of his former police chief to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu as the basis. The really important thing is that that kind of things could potentially produce a political paralysis at the top that could trigger the crisis point. But on this occasion, they managed to agree among themselves, different factions within the top of the leadership agree among themselves to get rid of both Xi Lai and handle it in a way that maintains stability and order. And that is the very model that the Communist Party uses to sustain its power on the foreseeable future. How often they will be able to do the same thing again and again successfully, we don't know. When they stumble on that, then the real crunch point comes. Do you want me to address any of the other points, or time's up?
No, I think that's time's up. So, Ben, would you like to give us your take-home message?
Yes, I think we've reached a sort of synthesis of sorts on Chinese nationalism, in the sense that it's not a 19th century colonial power. That's a false analogy, and a lot of the introductory way we set it up was misleading. I think the other main takeaway that I would hope people would take is that China is very much concerned with domestic stability. It's concerned about what goes on beyond its borders, but it's also focused ruthlessly, in my view, on stability at home, on retaining power. And if you don't understand that fundamental motivation of the party in Beijing, you don't really understand it at all. Finally, I think what I would try to take away is that we need to understand Chinese nationalism in its own terms. We need to understand the Chinese government's behaviour in its own terms. We mustn't project onto it a lot of things that we have from our own history. We need to understand the history of the regime and the history of the people, and we also need to understand the vast complexity of it as well. And then once we understand how much we don't know, we can then start to answer the question, is it a global hotspot or not?
Okay, finally, James, 60 seconds.
Well, I do commend you, Steve's book and Steve's paper and Ben's book, very much to you. I learned a lot from reading them. I think that Xi Jinping's mass line, his kind of repudiation of Bo Xilai's Maoism, only for him to faint in a slightly Maoist direction, not the real deal, but, you know, when he talks about the mass line and the party learning from the masses and so on, that is an indication of how tense they feel, and it's also an indication of the problems they might be building up for themselves in the future with the working class. Because if you say, look, the mass line, the masses, that's really where it's at, guys. You know, there's only so long you can do that before the masses say, OK, Mr. Z, you know, we'll take you seriously. I can't resist a parting shot to Ben and the political economy of the Independent newspaper, because, you know, though I agree with you, Ben, that, you know, China has boomed. Was it something I said, madam? I haven't completed the attack yet. The thing, you know, you're right to say that China has boomed despite the Communist Party rather than because of it. But I think you also say on page 190 that, China's boomed because of laissez-faire policies. And you recommend similar policies for today. But, just a few pages before page 190, on 177, you make the point that only four out of the top 100 Chinese companies are not state-owned. So if the Deng Xiaoping reforms of 78 onwards have been a victory for laissez-faire, then why is it the case that nearly everything in China is still state-run or state-controlled? I think you've got to square that circle, young man, or maybe employ a better book editor. But either way, I think the lesson is, when we move into 2014, let's not draw slick parallels with 1914. When even Steve says it's imperialism in Tibet, I don't agree with what China does in Tibet, but it's not the same imperialism, I'm sure Steve would agree, as, you know, Britain in the Raj or Britain in Africa. I do think that Ben is right to capture the nuances and the vulnerabilities in China's situation. I also think he's right that we shouldn't read ourselves into China. But I fear your laissez-faire prescriptions for China, Ben, might just do that.
OK, I've learned a lot. Thank you. Can we thank our speakers, please? hopefully Ben and James will be able to take this outside now. Thank you for listening.
Great stuff.
Good fun.
Listen, guys, I really love your work, and I'm going to be...